I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. We're going to talk about whether children are overprotected. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. Is life more dangerous, or are parents overprotective? That is the major question that we're going to talk about. We were all sitting around here in the studio. I'm going to introduce my guests in just a minute. And we were saying, is life more dangerous? What is happening? Why do statistics tell us about the different? What do statistics tell us about the difference between incidents of child abduction now compared to decades past? Are parents now more sensible? Or are super protective parents hurting children's sense of mastery and independence? Or here's a big question. Are protective parents getting slammed again because parent bashing is in vogue? That has been true for the last decade. Lots and lots of parent bashing out there. Okay. Also, senior producer Lori Mack has been doing a great job sitting in for me while I'm on assignment for the Food Schmooze, and I want to thank her for that. It continues, and she's just terrific. All right, let's start with what we did decades ago. Chris Prosperi is here from Metro Beast Restaurant in Simsbury, Connecticut. He's been a regular on the show, senior contributor here, and he and Alex Provence, who's also here from Hartford, regular contributor on the show, we were all sitting around talking, so we have to do something on this. Chris, what do you remember when you were growing up?
Transport us to, let's say, 1974, 75, right? So not a long, long time ago, but a good amount of time ago. And one of the memories I have, and this is something you'd never do now, is I have two brothers, a younger and an older, and we used to spend the weekends here in Connecticut. We lived in New York, and every Friday we used to get into the car, which was a big 70s station wagon, right? And we would come all the way from New York to Connecticut on all these big highways and stuff. And now everybody is seatbelted in, right? You would never not be in a seatbelt now. And we used to be in the back of the station wagon, you know, the space. And back then it was these huge spaces. And we had like a camp set up back there for the two-hour ride. I mean, and we were jumping around and wrestling back there and, you know, looking out the windows. Could you imagine now, fast forward to now, to 2015, you're just by yourself in the car. You're driving down Route 84 or 91 here in Connecticut or anywhere, and you look over to a car passing you. And there's three boys wrestling in the back of a station wagon while doing 75 miles down the an hour down the highway.
Well, Alex, that was probably true for you. I don't know if it was true for you back then.
I'm thinking I can't even drive my car, like find a new parking spot. You know, if I have to just roll my car down the street without wearing my seatbelt, I feel like it impairs my driving without a seatbelt.
Me too. Like, it's so important to me. I have doctor friends who've done their rotations in the emergency room in there. And so when you think back to this, I mean, a lot of the things we're talking about, what we all did or what our, you know, I have my sister said she would freely and bravely, courageously reveal herself, expose out herself for the good of the show so that we could look at this topic. I mean, the things that we did back then, you'd be arrested for today. I mean,
or at least looked down upon, right?
Parents are, you know, the so-called free-range parents who let their kids roam. Let's talk about roaming. Did you roam? I roamed everywhere.
And we both grew up in cities, right? You grew
up in Hartford.
And I grew up in one of the boroughs of New York, Queens, and roamed. Yeah, not just roamed, but I can remember we walked to school. And it was funny. And you don't think about it. Like, we didn't walk to school alone. There were just these groups of kids. And as you walk down the streets of New York, more kids joined in. And by the time you got to the school, there was like 20 of you walking together. But as you started out on your block, there was one and then two. And then as it grew, you walked to your school.
Chris, I walked to school and in the morning and in the afternoon at the end of school. And at lunchtime, I would come home to have my lunch by myself through downtown Hartford. And my mother, who was a wonderful parent, did not think a thing about it. My father didn't think anything. No one thought anything about it.
What did you have for lunch?
I had neighbors who would say to me, honey, go get me a pack of cigarettes and give me a dime or a nickel, sometimes a penny, And I would run down to the market and hand them cigarettes.
Yeah. I mean, could you imagine a child walking into a local little grocer right now and asking for a pack of cigarettes?
I know Paul Mall, Chesterfield's. I mean, yeah. It was just unbelievable. I mean, yeah. Amazing. So let me. We're going to tell some more stories on ourselves, and then get into. We're going to talk with Paula Fass, who is a professor emerita. At Berkeley and University of California, and is an historian of the history of childhood, and get some statistics. I mean, here's this question. Is it more dangerous today? Is this why we have all become so, so careful, so cautious, so fearful? Is that what's going on? Maybe it is. I don't know. We're going to find out.
I remember just the first time I picked up my niece. I was visiting my older brother in New Jersey, and he's like, oh, well, you're going to go pick up, you know, your niece at the school. Oh, I have to go with you. And I'm like, oh, I can do it. I know where the school is. And, no, you have to be on a list. And you actually had to go. And she wasn't like a baby. She was probably 10, 11 years old. And you had to go in the schoolyard. You had to be on a list, and you had to sign her out. Right, you had to go up and say, "I'm picking up Elizabeth," and then she was allowed to leave the schoolyard. And I thought back to like when my brother and I, we talked on the way home, was like, we never had to do that. Like no one came to pick us up. We just walked with the group of kids, like I said. But
when
now,
did seatbelts come into play? When did you have to wear a seatbelt? When did that become law?
I think I was driving. I think that 70s, was the 80s? Yeah, no, I think it was the 80s in Connecticut anyway. Every state had a different.
Because the irony, we had like a Volvo station wagon, which was so safe. Yeah. But like without seatbelts. Yeah.
Exactly.
Or they had lap belts,
right? What about drinking? Were you with grown-ups in the car?
In the car.
Piled with kids. You know, I'd be with my friends. They would invite them along, and we'd be going to a picnic and cruising through the countryside doing one of those stereotypical Sunday drives. And there would be a cooler, and the adults would be
drinking beer
having,
in the car.
Yes, oh, having a cocktail or having, and smoking their brains out with us in the car.
And this was normal. That's what I understand. I mean, a lot of people are probably sitting, oh my gosh, bad parent. No, this was, I think, thinking back to those times, those were normal. Getting picked up at an activity by my friend's parents and stuff, like, Sean's father's going to pick you up or whatever. And there being a cooler in the car and an open beer in his lap.
I think there's horrific accidents that back then that caused people to say, you know, this has got to change.
And right? I mean, to some degree, I mean, Chris, my parents, European, your parents, European. Mm-hmm. Yours French, mine British. Mm-hmm. Here, you know, actually, my parents were Scotch, as they would say. they wouldn't say British, but in any case, you have to ask yourself, Alex, your mother was from Spain, and so what is European? How about emotional intelligence back then? You know, what did that have to do with everything? How is that connected here? What about class? If you were someone with a certain amount of money, what did you do? What did you not do? What could you get away with? What couldn't you get away with? That is still true today. So I asked my sister, who's 13 years older than I am, and I said, what did you do with your kids, the boys, who are like my brothers and sisters? I said, you know what? I'm going to do this show. And she said, oh, I said, would you out yourself? And she said, absolutely, I will. And her husband chimed in, and he said, I'll do the same for the good of the show, because this is what it was like. So listen to this.
So where are we time-wise?
Oh, I would say we're talking about Sally was, 1958.
Okay, so late 50s, early 60s.
Yes, 58, let's say. Late 50s, early 60s. Okay. So she said, first of all, the boys would leave at 8 o'clock in the morning. They would just go off and play. They would just say, okay, we're going to play. And she had no idea where they were, and nor did any other parents. And they would off be having an adventure just as I did. That's exactly I did. And then they would appear for lunch. And then they would go out again and return at 6 o'clock because they knew around 6 o'clock was supper time. She said, I had no idea where they were. She said, I just had faith that they were somewhere in the neighborhood. And that was true for us. We'd be roaming around downtown Hartford and playing games in fields, and I mean, we just made up everything to do in the world.
Yeah, and my mom had a bell. And that's how you knew it was dinner or lunch.
You could hear it?
Yeah, in the neighborhood. You would hear this ding, ding, ding. You're like, is that your mom or my mom? Oh, it must be lunchtime. And we'd all, like you said, we'd all go and eat because you had to eat. Yeah. But no, they didn't know where we were. We'd be down by the lake. And we lived in the summer on a lake. And now you even think even scarier things could happen. And she never knew we were out in boats and jumping around.
Because I was on a sailboat. I spent my whole childhood on a sunfish going around. I don't even know if I had life preservers.
See, that's what I'm talking about.
That's another thing, right?
That's exactly the thing.
You know what? No, we did not have life preservers.
I did not have a helmet when I rode my bike. Nope. No one even thought about a helmet.
Nope. Or knee pads or elbow pads. Or
I don't know where. I mean, I worry how many kids were in the emergency room with concussions back then. You know, I think the helmets are a good idea. But on vacation, we would go to various vacation spots, oceanside places. And we would, you know, my mother's dear friend would go and, you know, all the kids would play together. And we'd just go off for the day in a strange place. We'd just wander off.
But it was adventurous, right?
Oh, it was so adventurous. We'd go in and out of lunch places and see what was doing. And people would dream up adventures and bang in through the screen door at the end of the...
So what's changed?
Well, you know, can I just tell you two more? Yeah. Because this is so really spectacular in terms of risk. My sister said, you know, she said, this is my most embarrassing thing. There were times that if the boys were in the car and it was the small market, I would just leave them in the car and go in and do a quick grocery shopping. What, you're waving me off?
That's just, that was normal. You don't have to go back to the 60s for that. We all did that. We never wanted to go to the inside the store. We wanted to go in the car and get out of the neighborhood maybe. So we would go to, you know, to the store with mom and dad, and they would go off and do shopping, and we would totally stay in the car and play in the car.
But I mean, I would be scared with my own children to do that today. I mean, wouldn't you?
No,
I'd
way.
Be terrified. I absolutely terrified. People steal. I mean, I'm scared that a dog would be stolen from the car.
See, and we would be left there for while my mom did the grocery shop. And we weren't the only ones. You'd look in other cars, and there were kids in them too. And then you would have conversations and hold up signs to kids in other cars.
Here's my brother-in-law. My brother-in-law's is a beauty. He said, I would drive the kids to Colorado. He said, this was after, you know, during my divorce, after my divorce. He said, so I'm a single dad. I would drive the kids by myself to Colorado every summer, not a seatbelt in sight. I would first stop at a grocery store, and the rule was they could carry out as much candy as they could hold in a giant bag. You know, I mean, they could get anything they wanted, and they could eat it all along the way.
Remember, Kool-Aid was just color with sugar.
I mean, absolutely. Yeah. Then he said, and because he was driving by himself, he's got two little kids in the car, he would go to a rest stop, and he'd say to the kids very seriously, you see that pole right there? You can only go between this car and the pole and no further than that. Do you understand me? And they would say, you know, yes. And he'd then go in the back and go dead asleep at a rest stop. And the kids could be outside the car playing between the car bumper and the pole, which was, you know, 15 feet. But still, at a rest stop, they're out playing. He said, one time a state trooper came by, and it was, you know, like 3 o'clock in the morning. And he said, are you kids all right? And they said, yep, my dad is taking a nap because he's driving. And he said, okay. And the trooper got in his car and then drove away and left them at 3 o'clock in the morning because this is how it was. I used to walk with my friend downtown Hartford to the movie theater. And the two little kids would go to the movies all by ourselves.
Go to the store by yourself, go to the movies by yourself, right? I mean, there were tons of things that we were, I guess, allowed to do by ourselves that you wouldn't even think of in a city now, especially in a city that you would let your kids
do. People with the big hill driveways, and you'd have the big wheel with the brake on the side.
Oh, my gosh, that's right.
Build a ramp.
You can't even, are those even legal
Alex,
anymore?
Big do you wheels? Remember you saw kids, you know, the whole gangs of kids when you were growing up in the pickup trucks, right?
Yeah, sitting on the back of the pickup truck going down a bumpy road, you know, jumping off the back and hopping back on again.
Totally.
Yeah.
I don't think you can ride it, right? I mean, now if you saw kids – I mean, I can't remember how many times – we used to go for rides in pickup trucks and sit on the wheel wells.
Yeah.
Like, could you imagine? I think that's a ticket now, right? The cops would pull you over.
I think people got really hurt. I mean, killed. Yeah.
And we would – yes. And we would you know, hit ourselves every once in a while. And, you know, what would they say?
They would say
shake it off. Oh, you'll be fine.
Walk it off.
But I think, you know, Alex had a point, and the fire marshal in my town, Kevin, who's a good friend of mine, he always says we're a reactionary society. So in other words, something has to happen, and then we change the way we look at things. But if nothing happens, then we don't change. So maybe that's why we are more like this.
We're
now.
Not suggesting in this litany, yeah. We're not suggesting that these are okay, these things that we did. Yeah. We don't know. Yeah. You know, this is the question of this show. Mm-hmm. How much more scary has life become? What was good about then and what was bad about then? How much is paranoia and how much is justified fear for the safety of your charges? You know, this is what we're talking about here on the show. Coming up, we have an expert, a historian on the history of childhood. And I'd be interested to hear what she has to say. Quick break, and then we'll be right back with more. I'm Faith Middleton with Chris Brosberry of Litchfield County and Alex Province of Hartford, and we have been talking about childhood, and we're asking whether today's parents are overprotecting their children or they're acting appropriately because life is more dangerous than ever. Join the conversation at 203-776-9677. That's 203-776-WNPR. Can't wait for this. Our guest is Paula Fass, and she's the Margaret Byrne Professor of History Emerita at the University of California at Berkeley. She taught there for 36 years. She has been Distinguished Scholar in Residence at Rutgers University in New Brunswick, New Jersey, is past president of the Society of the History of Children and Youth. She is an historian, you might say, of the history of childhood. And I think that is the most fascinating area of research. Paula Fass, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Faith. It's good to be with you. I was overhearing your conversations and can tell you that these are conversations taking place in many parts of the country these days.
We know, as you do, Dr. Fass, that parents, so-called free-range parents, who think there is something to be gained by letting your children roam to some degree and to have a sense of independence the way that many of us did years ago. There's a couple of cases where parents have been arrested. And so we want to talk with you about whether things are more dangerous. What's happening out there as you see it, as you survey this conversation?
Well, there have been a number of changes, and among them, I would say, the increasing media attention has elevated our sense of concern. And I think that really began in the late 70s and early 80s. After a period of real transformation in American social mores and family life. And I think that change really created a kind of alert that was most prominent, for example, in something that I have studied, which is child kidnapping, so that people became really, really obsessed, and I include myself among them, with the possibility that their children would be kidnapped by strangers.
Mm.
In fact, we know that the chances of being kidnapped by strangers is very low today, and we don't know whether that's any different than the past. But I can tell you that having studied the subject, there have been many, many instances of child kidnapping in American history starting in the late 19th century. But never before had we become so obsessional about it. Never before had it become used to the degree that it happened after the Eitan Potts case in New York, where everybody thought that the next day their own child could disappear. And people were having their children's fingerprints and footprints taken so that if a body was found, they could potentially identify it. That kind of horrifying possibility was just never laid out there to the same degree. I have a theory about why that happened.
Yeah, what do you think?
Well, I think there were a lot of changes in family life. The first, of course, being that mothers went out to work when their children were quite young. And I think there was an increasing onus being placed on mothers to take care of their children. And the fact was that as mothers did go to work, there were fewer mothers in neighborhoods. So while in the 1950s or 60s, in the period that you were talking about before, your own mother might not know where you were, but there were mothers around or parents around who were keeping eyes out on children. That begins to disappear by the 1980s as fewer and fewer mothers are at home, not just mothers of their own children, mothers of other children.
Oh.
And I think a lot of people realize that there just isn't the same kind of potential patrolling going on in the neighborhood.
That's so interesting. This amazing thing happened. I had a meeting in New York City. Our studios are in New Haven, and I had a meeting in New York City yesterday, went in for that, and then drove back here very early this morning. And I'm on the West Side Highway in New York, and all of a sudden, I look up at this giant screaming billboard across the highway, and it is flashing Amber Alert.
Uh-huh.
And I could feel my whole body clutch up, and I just thought, oh, my God, in this car, I could look to my left or right, does one of these cars have this child? And I was just obsessed with it, and then it hit me. I can't believe I'm doing this show today. This, you know, this is the kind of fear that we live with, you know, just seeing that it's not, I mean, somebody was kidnapped. That's real.
Well, but, you know, Faith, we don't know what kind of kidnapping it was. And it was much more likely to have been a custody dispute, parental or family kidnapping, than a stranger abduction. I mean, there are hundreds of thousands of those a year. And those are also part of the Amber Alert system. One of the things that happened in the 80s was that there was a real confusion, an intentional confusion, that was created about the source of the lost child, so that the statistics were tremendously inflated, and we got numbers like 500,000 children to 750,000 children disappear every year. And that included children who were runaways, and most of all, children who were taken by non-custodial parents and were kept for longer than the allowed time.
What was the purposeful confusion, do you think?
Well, I think it really was this sense of alarm about children that was taking place. And the media has, for a very long time, literally since the late 19th century, feasted on these human interest stories of children disappearing. Now, the media has also increased enormously, whereas before, say, in the late 19th or early 20th century, it was newspapers, and newspapers alone, and then eventually radio. But, you know, now it's everywhere, including the highway sign that you saw this morning. The media is just all around us, and the kind of paranoia and alerts that it can create has increased a lot. I mean, this kind of sensationalism, you know, the sense of being hit in the pit of your stomach, that this is happening to somebody's child and it could potentially happen to mine, that, I think, is a modern experience that has made it almost impossible for responsible parents to allow their children to play outside in an unregulated way, the way we were talking about. There is also another dimension to the media, and that is that parents now are very censorious to each other. You know, you get all of these blogs where people comment.
Yeah.
It's a kind of parental mafia. Oh, you're not taking good care of your own child. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a different kind of media intervention, but it's also a media intervention. Mm-hmm. And a lot of young mothers that you talk to today are experiencing that. What, you mean you're not breastfeeding until the age of 12 months or 2 years or whatever?
Yeah, yeah.
Or you're not doing this or that. And so I think there's an intensification of the blame game.
Dr. Fass, let me ask you this, because we have a psychologist who's often on the show, Dr. Nancy Horn in New Haven. And years ago, she said to me, oh, we are in a time of parent bashing. And do you see that? She said, you know, parents are, everywhere you look, being blamed for everything.
I think that's correct. I think they're being blamed for everything, and they're blaming each other for everything. There's an almost competitive parenting that's going on. And as a result, you're never good enough. You're never careful enough. You're never supervising enough. So I do think that the entire atmosphere has become pervaded with that kind of parent bashing. I think it's a good term, very good term.
Hmm. Are there more, I don't know if you're in possession of these statistics, but are there more child abductions now than there were back in the 50s, 60s?
Well, all I can tell you is that we didn't start collecting statistics nationally on this until the 1980s. So that the only way you would be able to get any reasonable statistics would be to go from locale to locale, not just state by state, but locale, city by city, county by county. And that doesn't exist. Nobody has collected that. So we simply do not have an accurate and effective way of making that kind of calculation. And even today, a lot of that statistical work that we have is largely voluntary. People send the statistics into the national centers. Then the FBI was not even involved in collecting statistics until a law was passed in 1982.
So with parents now, both parents in many families working, if there are two parents, there aren't as many watchful eyes in neighborhoods looking at children, seeing what they're doing, saying, you go home, I'm going to tell your mother. You know,
Yes, exactly.
You know, that kind of stuff. If so, that's lessened.
There's something that has increased, and that is we are more and more, we more and more imagine that our children are sexually vulnerable. You know, in the past, the kind of sexuality of children was never on the front burner. We thought about children as being innocent. And again, the changes of the 1970s and 80s, where sexuality became a much more pervasive part of the culture, and where, if you remember and you may not remember, there was more and more advertising taking place that was using children as kind of erotic models.
Yeah, I do.
So this kind of the sexualization of the culture in general, where more and more kinds of sex became public, and the fear that children were potentially sexual objects because of the use of children to arouse sexual interest, I think made us clutch, made us so much more fearful that they were that there could be predators of all kinds, not just kidnapping predators, but predators who would sexually abuse children. So I think that very same time also creates that change and that new awareness of the potential vulnerability of children, I think.
Wow. So what I'm hearing from you is that we have a stew, and some of the ingredients in that stew are based on reality, and some are a kind of paranoia for understandable reasons.
Yes, I think that's a good way to put it. And yet we cannot, I wouldn't be able to say to you that our children are more endangered or less endangered? Are they safer? Are they less safer? Very difficult to say, because that stew that you're describing is so thick that you cannot really differentiate between what's real and what's subjectively in our minds.
Yeah. Yes. When I saw that Amber Alert this morning on the highway, the first thing that was in my head was, oh, my God, I have a responsibility. I bet this parent is sitting there begging the universe, please, somebody, keep your eyes open. Maybe you will see my child. And then I started looking in car windows, and I thought, you know, that's my responsibility. And I was just stunned by the sense of what that must feel like to this parent somewhere, if, in fact, the perpetrator isn't known to the parent.
Well, there's no way we can get around the fact that for some parents who have had that experience, it is the worst experience that one can imagine.
Oh, yeah.
So I think that really has to be acknowledged.
Yeah.
That there are parents who have lost their children in the worst possible way. And the pain that those parents have to experience is horrible. And so you responded, I think, totally appropriately. On the other hand, if we respond to, well, I'm sure while you had Amber Alert in New York, we must have had several of them out here in California, and many in Minnesota and in Illinois, et cetera, et cetera. So that in total, we get an elevated sense of panic. I think the sense of responsibility, we should have responsibility for each other's children. And we should feel the pain that a parent has when something so terrible happens. What we shouldn't be feeling, and which I feel all the time, is this excess anxiety, this really intensified obsession that something terrible is happening to children. Now, there are children to whom some terrible things are happening. I'm thinking of ghetto children where guns and drive-by shootings are taking place all the time.
Yeah.
And that, I think, and if we look at them, we can say definitely things have gotten worse. The numbers have increased. There are more, and there are more weapons of, you know, in high-caliber weapons, semi-automatic weapons that make a shooting a necessary massacre. But if you're talking about most middle-class experiences in cities or suburbs or smaller towns, I don't honestly think that our children are in more danger today than they were 40 or 50 years ago.
But I hear you, class, your position in society, how much money or resources you have does make a difference in how you answer these questions we're asking.
Absolutely.
Oh, my goodness. It is a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for being on the show. And it has made me, reading about your life, we discovered you doing research for the show, and reading about the things that you've been interested in has made us want to read everything you've written. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Let me tell you that I have a new book coming out next year called The End of American Childhood. So maybe we can talk again.
You bet. It's as soon as we see that book is out, you will be on the show. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
All right. Dr. Bye-bye. Paula Fass, bye-bye, who's the Margaret Byrne Professor Emerita at the University of California at Berkeley and a distinguished scholar in residence at Rutgers in New Jersey. We're going to take a short break, and then we'd like to hear from you at 203-776-WNPR about childhood safety and independence. Stay with us. Thank you. I'm Faith Middleton. It's the hottest scene in Connecticut. Our Food Schmooze Martini Competition, statewide bartenders shake up innovative martinis, and you vote for the Food Schmooze Martini Champion. Designated driver discount, great top chef noshes, our DJ sizzles, and this thing sells out. It's very close to that, actually. Thursday, June 25th at 6 p.m., Simsbury's Riverview. Thanks to Power Station Events, $60 tickets to benefit WNPR, and you can order right now at ctmartini.org. All right, I'm with Chris Brassberry and Alex Province on the show, and we are discussing this issue of what has happened to all of us, the fear that we all fear, some of it paranoia, some of it so justified. Progress has been made in some situations, and in other times we pass rules and regulations after only a few things have happened. And so, as our guest was saying, a professor of the history of childhood, that stew consists of things that are real and justified and also not justified. So we want to talk with you about it. 203-776-WNPR. Chris, welcome to the show, and thank you for holding on through our conversation. Go ahead, Chris.
Hi, Faith. How are you?
Great, thanks. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you. I wanted to let you know that my wife and I practice free-range parenting. We let our 7-year-old daughter, you know, run around outside without us there. We don't supervise a lot of her play. She climbs trees. She goes rock climbing. She falls down. She bumps herself. She comes in crying. We say, "You're not hurt," because she's not. And then she goes back out. It kind of scares me to see how some helicopter parents are just completely babying their children. And I've seen examples of this where 17, 18-year-olds are bringing their parents in to job interviews. And I think that's the type of child you're creating if you hover over your kid when they're young.
So, Chris, did you know, you heard our guest, I bet, Dr. Fast, saying several times in her conversation that even she gets nervous because none of us are immune to the Amber Alert warning that comes along. Hearing one thing happening to one particular child and getting scared it's going to happen to your precious cargo. So do you get scared ever? I mean, in the beginning when you were trying what we call now free-range parenting, for us it was just normal growing up, but, you know, were you scared in the beginning that something was going to happen to your child? How did you work yourself into this?
I've never been scared because that's the way I grew up. I'm 35 years old, so you know, when I was a kid, you know, in the summer, my mom would say, "Go outside and play and don't come in till I call you for lunch." And, you know, there was no direct supervision. And we were smart enough because our mm-hmm. parents raised us to be smart enough.
Okay, but Chris, what about Dr. Fast saying there aren't as many eyes, parents' eyes, you know, mothers at home as there were watching out for all the kids in the neighborhood and saying, "You stop that and don't you do this, I'm going to tell your mother." What about that? I mean, that is a very good point.
I think it's very valid, absolutely. But I think that's, for me, that's all the more reason to empower my daughter to learn to make decisions on her own. So if she's running in the backyard and trips over a rock and falls and skins her knee, that's a really good life lesson. You know, watch where you're stepping. Uh-huh.
Here's the kind of thing we're talking about. I have a relative who said about her children, we live right up close next to the road, and I have to sit in the backyard. That's in the front of the house, but in the backyard, I watch them like crazy. We say, why so tightly? And she said, what if they make the wrong choice once, and they go out into that busy road, and something happens to them? None of us can argue with that idea. That's a scary idea. They live on a busy, busy street with lots of traffic. These are the kinds of questions that parents are having to ask themselves. And plus add in everything that we in the media are talking about abductions, about one thing and another. You see what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. And I think living on a very busy street, you know, obviously you're going to have to treat it a little bit differently. You know, if mm-hmm. I lived on a very busy street, I wouldn't just let her run out and play, you know, certainly at a very young age. You know, at seven, she's old enough to know that you don't go near the street, you know, and mm-hmm. you're absolutely right. What if they make that one wrong decision? But I guess, and this may sound insensitive, but I guess we could be saying that for everyone through the rest of their life. What if they make that one bad decision and things like that happen?
Mm-hmm.
What my wife and I have decided is that, you know, we are going to empower her to make the right decisions from what we've taught her, and we believe that even at 7 years old, she's capable of making good decisions about her own personal safety.
Do you live in the city or the country?
It's more in the country, up in Granby.
Okay.
So it's certainly not a city.
And have you given her a good, solid talk, maybe multiple times, about when to talk to strangers and when not to talk to strangers?
Absolutely. All the time, we continue to reinforce it. And I think that's part of it, continued reinforcement of the values and, you know, essentially safety rules that we want her to live by.
You know, it is, I think two things when you're saying this. Black parents talking about what it is like to have that first conversation with their children about what prejudice is. Perhaps there are many gay parents doing the same thing. And then I think how hard it is for all parents to have that kind of conversation with their children, to say there are very bad people sometimes and they will try tricks to get you to go in the car with them. And you have to say that stuff and you think, I can't believe I'm going to have to shatter your innocence about the world. But, you know, that's realism. But these are hard questions. You know, these are judgments every parent's trying to make and do it well. I have to say people are well-intentioned. Chris, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Go ahead.
You know,
Chris Prosperi.
As he was saying that, I'm just like, yeah, my parents taught us that stuff. I mean, so maybe it's true. We didn't just go out into the wild, right? My parents did reinforce talking to strangers, and we weren't just like let loose to go out and play. Mm-hmm. I mean, we did have those conversations.
The reinforcement of good.
Yeah, and
good
it was not just once. It wasn't just one conversation, then it was over. It was constant reinforcement.
You know, one of the first times I remember this kind of thing creeping into my childhood was, and I don't remember if it had been my mother or some adult said to us at Halloween in Hartford as we were going to trick-or-treat in a big gang in apartment buildings, you know, with many shopping bags filled with candy, they said, it's been on the news, some bad person is putting razor blades in the candy.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah,
I do. You must be careful.
Yeah.
And I remember all of us, you know, having this shiver of fear of really.
And then your parents checking your candy when it came back.
Yeah,
right?
That was the first time.
And taking the best candy.
Yeah. That was your parents.
Darlene, welcome to the show. Faith Middleton with Chris Prosperi and Alex Province. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. Thank you very much. I just started listening to your show. It was very interesting.
Thank you, Darlene.
What I wanted to bring up is the professor had some very good points. I myself am a single mother of three children. I used to live in the Bronx, New York, and I did move to Connecticut because, unfortunately, living in urban areas, there are some things our children are subject to.
Yeah.
Now, I understand her theory on the whole fear situation, but what she's lacking and what's lacking in the media is the fact that African-American children have been kidnapped, and the number has increased over the last couple of years. In fact, there's a foundation called the Black and Missing and Not Forgotten Foundation that's out in Maryland.
Hmm.
And, you know, with the rise of social media and everything else, we're seeing more and more stuff that will generate fear. And what people don't understand is that there are a lot of single mothers. Some of us live in areas where we have over 150 registered level 3 predators living in the area. Some of them don't get checked out. You know, there is no supervision, you know, and we still manage to let our children go to school, even though there has been, you know, with cases which have not made the media of children being sodomized, you know, being raped in some of these New York City public schools. And also, you know, just the neighborhoods alone themselves. And believe it or not, sometimes in these areas, people do look out for each other because of how bad it is. So it's very easy for the previous gentleman to talk about how he's free-range parenting, lends his daughter run around, but you have to think about the area where these children are being raised. my daughter's a little bit more tougher than the children in the town that we live in, because she's seen stuff and she's been exposed to a number of things because of, you know, other children who've been exposed to other things that I don't expose her to.
Yes, Darlene. I think we got into this, ran out of time with Dr. Fast, but just started to get into how there are neighborhoods where, of course, rates of crime are higher. We know that in African-American communities, the rate of crime is actually highest there. And of course, that would probably carry over into the kind of child abduction stuff that you're talking about. So thank you so much for reinforcing that idea. Thank you for calling.
You're welcome.
Okay, bye, Darlene, and good luck. 203-776-9677. Yeah, so I thought that was so interesting when Dr. Fass said that, bear in mind that a lot of the majority of abductions are known persons. In other words, usually a parent, one of the parents abducting the child.
Yeah, and I was thinking, I got that same thing. I was driving back from D.C. and I got an Amber Alert, believe it or not, on my phone. And the Amber Alert actually was pretty detailed, which I was amazed. It gave the type of car, it gave the description of the child, the description of the abductor too. And it was a custody battle between a husband and wife. And that's exactly what the Amber Alert that I got on my phone. And then I did actually see it on the highway. And it was that, it was a custody dispute and one parent grabbed the kid and ran.
And it seems like I think the Amber Alert is a tremendous thing, even though it does send fear into our hearts. Tremendous thing, because there's a window of high opportunity right at the start of the abduction where if everybody looks, you know, it was like that autistic boy lost in New York City. I mean, I was going to get on a train and just start looking.
Yeah.
You know, I just could not bear the idea that this child was wandering around and autistic, probably very frightened. You know, so these alerts are so good in themselves. But there's blowback. So, John, welcome to the show.
Hi, Faith. I know you only have a few minutes left, but
yeah.
I think one thing that hasn't been talked about, and with the history of this whole thing, I think we're in uncharted waters, and that being the internet has added a whole different element of safety to our kids. And, you know, on many levels, I think one of them is pornography and the volume of pornography that's on the internet. And when our kids get into this stuff at a young age, it just changes them, I think. So,
John, can I say thank you for bringing that up? We had a state police digital expert in our studio. He brought a laptop on the show live. We ran cords into this studio, and Chris, where you're sitting, he said, watch this. And within a minute of opening and posting himself as a 13-year-old girl, he was being hit on, that so-called child was being hit on by every kind of predator. And we were shocked. And he was only reading half the messages to her because he couldn't say them on the air. So this stuff is real, John. We know that. Yeah.
I know. We
Thank
didn't
you.
Have that 30 years ago. You know, we didn't have that 40, 50 years
ago.
When
I wish I'd brought that up with Dr. Fass. I thank you so much. When we have her on again, we will. Thanks, John. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, so last minute, what are our conclusions? So we took greater risks when we were kids in our middle class neighborhoods, let's say, than many kids do today. Although kids in under-resourced communities live with unbelievable risk. Yeah. So, but fascinating, we know that there is a stew of things to be truly worried about and things not to be worried about. Some of it is paranoia, and we just have to make our choices and our judgments. It's been great having you both on the show. Thank you so much. Alex Province of Hartford, Chris Prosperi of Litchfield County. Our producers are Lori Mack and Jonathan McNichol. Thanks again to Lori Mack for sitting in for me while I'm on assignment. For the Fooch Moos in New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.